Hey folks, I hope you're listening to this episode having heard the previous episode. This is not a normal Witch Police Radio podcast. It's part two of my favorite local albums of the year. The previous episode you would have heard numbers 15 through 6, and this one is my top 5. So as I said in the other one, there's probably tons of stuff that I missed. Every year when I sort of compile these lists, I always realize after I've released the list that there's stuff I forgot. There's records that I really enjoyed that I forgot came out this year, or for whatever reason, I just missed them when I was making a list of my top 15. And so if you're in a band and you're not on the list and you think you should be, let me know. There could be a reason why it didn't make the list. And it's not necessarily that I didn't like it. Maybe I didn't realize it came out in 2022. Or in some cases, I'm not including albums that were released digitally in 2022, but don't have physical releases until 2023. So there's a lot of reasons why I chose things, why I didn't choose things, but here on this episode, you will hear my top 5 selections from the list, which is always has a potential to be wrong. But it's my list, so my show, my list, whatever. So, in most cases, in 4 of the 5 albums on this list, I also interviewed the artists this year. And that happens a lot. I mean, I do over 100 episodes in a calendar year, and a lot of people are on the show talking about new records, so it just kind of makes sense that I've talked to a lot of these people about their albums. And on this episode, you'll hear a brief introduction to the record, kind of why I chose it, and then for 4 of the 5, you will hear a clip from an interview I did with the artist, and then a song. So I hope you enjoy. Next episode, going back to a regular programming where it's me interviewing a band. But for now, this is episode 2, or part 2, of my favorite albums, locally released, of 2022. If you're like me, you probably have a closet full of local band merch. And whether you know it or not, a lot of that band merch is probably made by Divine Shirt Company right here in Winnipeg. Divine Shirt Company has made all of the Great Witch Police merch, from our hoodies to our toques to our t-shirts. And if you're looking to get anything done, like screen printing, embroidery, graphic design, digital printing, go to see Divine Shirt Company at divineshirtcompany.ca and tell them Witch Police Radio sent you.
One of our colleagues, Sam Thompson, who, if you saw him, you'd sort of right away assume he was a hippie.
Get up off your ass and get up on the podcast! Witch Police Radio! Witch Police Radio! Witch Police Radio! Witch Police Radio! Get up off your ass and get up on the podcast! Witch Police Radio!
Okay, so first up, we have Null by Ken Mode. Ken Mode is one of those bands where, you know, they kind of make the list every time they release something. They've been around for decades now. The first time I saw them live would have been 98 or 99 or so. It's been a long time that I've been listening to them. And they just keep getting better and better, which is not always a given for a band, really. I mean, to have been around for as long as they have and continue to improve and continue to make, you know, fairly groundbreaking music. And Null is excellent. Obviously, it wouldn't be on the list if it wasn't. They've expanded to a 4-piece now, which has given them like a whole range of sounds that they haven't had in the past, as far as synthesizers and especially saxophone. And I think that element has just kind of really fleshed out their sound in a way that maybe I didn't realize was possible when listening to their albums in the past. And this is also the first part of a 2-part album release. So they have another album coming out this year, or this coming year, that is going to be kind of the second half of this release. But Null on its own, it stands alone, it's great. I highly recommend it. If you like Ken Mode, you're obviously gonna like this. It's just as aggressive, just as heavy, but it has these kind of added elements of, like I said, the synth, the saxophone, and as I also said, they've been improving technically. I think the songs, the songwriting has improved sort of record to record. And so this is, I think, their 8th album, and yeah, they continue to be awesome. So here's a clip from an interview with Ken Mode frontman Jesse Mathewson, followed by a song.
We're gonna try to start writing earlier than that, but then obviously the pandemic started like March 2020.
Yeah.
We'd begun writing probably near the end of 2019, and I basically threw all that material out.
Okay.
Lost my mind, threw everything out, started from scratch alone. And that's kind of where we've come to now. We wrote and recorded two albums last fall, and part of the reason it became that is we're trying to schedule, trying to bring our producer, Andrew Schneider, who lives in New York, up here. And we just couldn't until the latter half of last year. So, we kind of, all along, we decided we were going to try to record everything that we had. And it just became so much that we had to make the call. Like, we're not the kind of band that, like, a big deluxe two, like, double record arc would really work. I don't see people buying that. We're a bit much for, like, I don't know, if you listen to it for 75 minutes straight. So we figured we'd try to make two, like, distinct statements out of it that also fit together as one statement. Cool. So that's what we've come to. We have the Null album coming out September 23rd now on Artifact Records.
And then the follow-up is the second part of that, which you've already recorded at the same time?
Oh, it is, yeah. And it's done. The artwork's all done. Yeah, it was all done by the same people, same time, basically as one record, other than it will look different and it will sound different because for the most part, they were kind of written in the two different periods. Much of the Null record, with the exception of the last track, Unresponsive, much of it was written more in 2020. And then as we started being able to get together more, we wrote more as a band. So a lot of the material on the Null record, I wrote on my own.
Okay.
And I played all the instruments and then taught everyone else them. And then for the most part, it's how I wrote it, other than Shane can completely dunk on me as a drummer because I'm not a drummer.
Is that very different from how you usually write? Is it usually a lot more collaborative?
It has been the last many, many years. It's been a lot more collaborative. That was the one thing the only positive thing that came of the pandemic for me is I taught myself to finally learn how to record stuff on a computer. I kind of flirted with it back in 2007, but it's a completely different world for that sort of stuff now. Like, computers are all way more powerful. All the tools to record yourself are way easier to learn, and a lot of the gear is a lot cheaper. I invested in kind of, I'd say meager, like some opening, like just beginner stuff, and then I quickly started to buy a little bit better equipment. But for the most part, like, I don't have delusions of grandeur. I'm not going to try and replace some of the people that, like, we work with when we go to the studio, because that's one of the things I really get a kick out of is being able to hire some of the best people in the world and bring them up to Winnipeg.
Well, and you have done that, you know, repeatedly.
Yeah, quite literally. Like, it's, and I mean, part of that is the benefit of living in a place like Winnipeg, where we have programs like Manitoba Film and Music, where they do, I mean, for a band like us who has the accolades that we have and the know-how to write the grants for them, they've been very kind to us for basically since we won that Juno. We've been getting our albums supported by them, so we end up making records that we probably shouldn't make on our own. It kind of just takes our budget and doubles it, so it's we've been very fortunate. Granted, part of the reason it is so expensive is because to work with these people, we have to bring them to Winnipeg to do it. Generally speaking, if you work with them in the U.S. where they're at home, it's cheap. But anyway, regardless, we've got to work with some of the best people in our genre, period. So it's been very, very cool. And I'd like to continue doing that. So, but anyway, I kind of went on a tangent there. I learned how to demo stuff on a computer, which has allowed me to experiment a lot more with our songwriting, more so than I've ever been able to in the past. Because a lot of the time I'd have these crazy ideas, but because I didn't play the instruments or have the gear, we would have to try and wing it in the studio, and I'd bring people in and we'd try the things out. And it's like, yeah, that doesn't really work. And especially with a band that, like, plays the way we do and has the type of tones that we do, it's not always easy to fit other instruments in there. You have to, like, spend a lot of time crafting a place for another instrument, especially since we've been a three piece since 1999. Like, I don't usually leave space for other things, so.
Next up is a record by Christine Fellows called Stuff We All Get. And this is an artist that I haven't had on the podcast yet. I would love to, so if Christine, if you hear this, or if anyone who knows Christine hears this and wants to help make the connection, love to have you on the podcast someday. But this is this came out earlier this year, and when I heard it was coming out on the Vivat Virtute label, I was very excited. Her previous album, Roses on the Vine, was excellent, and I have a number of her other CDs, you know, going back to past decade and a half or more. And yeah, I'm just generally a fan. One thing you might notice on this episode of my top five is there's a lot of storytelling, a lot of singer-songwriter style stuff, and you know, really, really thought-provoking lyrics. And that seems to be something that I'm into. The older I get, the more I care about that storytelling kind of vibe and about people creating, you know, people, places, spaces, scenes in their lyrics. And I think that on this record, Christine Fellows really does this. I know that I'm judging this based on the music on the album, which is great, like I said, but there's also a visual element to this record that has been released kind of over the past few months online, and I highly recommend you check it out. If you've seen the album cover, it's very evocative, and Christine has done this whole series of visual video projects in a similar style to illustrate the songs on the record. So, highly recommended. If you liked Roses on the Vine, you'll love this. I think it's even better. And yeah, Stuff We All Get, Christine Fellows. There's no interview here because I have not had Christine on the podcast ever. But yeah, check out the song, and maybe we'll get her on the show at some point. Next one is, I think it's technically a demo, but I included it in the albums because it's a tape, came out on a tape, it was released, a physical release and a digital release, and I really like it. It's the debut release from the band Age of Self, which is a hardcore band made up of people from, you know, various projects in the Winnipeg music scene. They've come together. I don't know if you want to call it a super group. I like that word, but I know a lot of people don't. But it's people you know from various bands who have formed like Voltron and created this really, really awesome hardcore band. And it's a tape, it's only a few songs, but I really dig the kind of directness and simplicity of it. And in the interview I did with frontman Cam Scott, we talked a lot about sort of that idea that hardcore is this simple style of music, and it's very straight ahead, but there's often a lot more depth to it, sonically as well as kind of conceptually and lyrically and thematically. So this is a really cool record because it's thought-provoking, and I know I used that in the previous description of the previous album, but that's definitely something that comes to mind when listening to this tape. It's thought-provoking hardcore. It's not just bash you over the head, 1.5 minute songs, fast, loud, fast rules. I mean, it is that, but it also has kind of deeper elements, and I'm a sucker for this kind of style of hardcore. It's always nice to hear something new that has this kind of old sound that is just a punch in the face, but also makes you think. And I think that's what sort of defines this Age of Self release. I'm really excited about hearing more. Hopefully they put out something else in 2023. And I saw a very brief portion of their live show a few months back, and it was great. And so this is definitely a band that I'm hoping to see live more and catch a full set of going forward. So, clip from my interview with Cam, and here's a song from Age of Self. What is it like now? I mean, I know you've been singing in hardcore bands, if you want to call it singing, for a long time now, for decades now, really, right? What is it like now doing this, going back to this, after, you know, having originally done it when you were much younger, and especially with this kind of content too, your ideals, I'm not sure if how they've changed over the years, or your kind of the things you want to talk about on a record or at a show, but is it different? Like, are you looking at things from a different perspective at this point in your life, even though you're doing, you know, sonically similar, loud, angry, fast music?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's changed in a few really interesting ways for me personally, but I think for all of us. You know, one of the things that I am concerned about in terms of my own artistic output, I mean, I enjoy a lot of the records that I've been on and the bands I've been in, so take this with a grain of salt, but there is this quality of nihilism or miserabilism to a lot of hardcore, do you sure. know, that I don't think it's that simple. I think that the portrayal of these intensely negative intentions and emotions in music is intrinsically constructive. If you're working through it in that setting, it has a constructive social content, almost irrespective of the message, quote unquote, you know. But it is hard to sustain that kind of negative intention toward the world. And I would say at this point, all of us, I feel pretty confident that I can speak for this project as a whole when I say that we have a pretty different intentionality toward this music. You know, it's a total love cry. It's our highest aspiration, and it's a beautiful thing to do together.
Yeah.
We don't want to succumb to the negativity or the nastiness that often attends hardcore that I've participated in, I think more so than anyone else in the band, you know, but we're doing it with a certain kind of intentionality that, like, all the interceding experience becomes a part of. I think we're kind of using everything we know, all of the musics that we love,
yeah,
are somewhere in the backdrop of our resolve to play this kind of pretty Spartan music.
Well, that's interesting, because I think you're right that stuff doesn't, you can't avoid that happening, right? So whatever you're listening to, or whatever you've played over the years and you've been interested in, it's going to seep through in some way or another. But I think that most people hearing this hearing the tape would say this is a hardcore band. This is very straight ahead. I mean, this is what hardcore sounds like. But it's interesting to hear that there's obviously, I think with any band really, there's all that stuff in the background that is coming in there. And the fact that you were all doing different music, very different from this band before this, and probably still, it's kind of cool to re-listen to it, I guess, with that in mind, and see if it's something that can be picked out. I mean, it's not obvious for sure, but under the surface maybe there's some of those elements.
Yeah, because I think that hardcore it has negative conditions too. I mean negative, not in the sense of the miserableism I was talking about before, but it's nourished also by all the things that it isn't. It's
right.
Its purity and intensity comes from the fact that it contrasts so much of the acceptable emotion and range of expression of the world. You know, it's a space where you can really wig out if you need to. You can
be very strident
in a way that you couldn't on the bus or at work or in most situations. But also, you know, that extremity is obviously because it's a node of a really, really complex musical ecology that I think that's another thing that comes with age, is that we all love this music, but the more things that you engage, you know, I feel like the more I love this music for precisely what it is, you know, in relation to all of the other sounds that we consume that we could be making, we want to play this kind of music, loud band, you know, we want to play this kind of music because of the things that it is so good at and good for.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I think that people often, punk rock in general, they tend to sort of gloss it over as, oh, it's three chords, it's you know, these 2 minute songs, there's not any substance to it, it's some guy yelling about the government, whatever, right? A lot of people who don't really give it the time to listen to aren't hearing kind of the space in between the 2 minutes of chaos and sort of what's behind it. And I think that as someone who listens to like really unnecessary amounts of reggae, like, I mean, that's been my kind of genre of choice for most of my life. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. People have this idea of it being this one thing if they don't really delve into it. And I think that the punk and hardcore are the same thing, where it's easy to kind of just pass it over as, oh, that's just simple, it's a couple chords, they're not good at music, it's this, you know, this throwaway trend. But obviously all of these styles of music have lasted. I mean, hardcore in this kind of form has lasted for decades now, and it hasn't really changed that much. Like, there's always been this appeal to that kind of hardcore, and I mean, same thing with reggae. I mean, you know, there's sounds from the 60s that are still quite popular, and you can still do that now in the exact same way, and it can have the same impact. And I don't know, what do you think is the kind of ongoing appeal of hardcore? Because it really hasn't. I mean, you can listen to your tape and you can listen to something from 1983, and there's differences, but I mean, at the core of it, it's sort of the same basic thing. But there's been so much time and so many different things in between that could have changed it, but it's got this purity to it.
Yeah. I mean, I could give like a terribly personal anecdotal answer, or like a pseudo scholarly answer, but the thing that fascinates me about hardcore are these two contradictory aspects, right? Where on one hand, it's supposed to be this perennially interesting, refreshing youth culture.
Yeah.
And I can't stake a claim to that. I can't say that I represent it in the guise of like youthfulness anymore, I guess. So glad to have survived that phase and identify with it in a different capacity. But that's because the rudimentary elements of hardcore are supposed to be accessible to anybody who wants this submersive experience of music. You can pick up a guitar. It's very instrumentally transparent. You can get a drum set. You can simply howl and you will discover something like hardcore. But actually, you know, we know it's not that simple, because you're talking about reggae and all the contrasts that comprise this decades old music, right? And similarly, you know, we listen to hardcore punk, we know it's not that simple because it's terribly formalized. There's all these like rhythmic conventions and structural conventions. Anybody who lives and breathes hardcore is going to geek out over it in this hyper referential way, with all of this super granular, almost like geographical specificity. Oh, it sounds like UK 82. It's like US Midwestern hardcore, Boston, LA, these antennas, you know, that it's pretty well researched, hyper referential music for its alleged spontaneity, right? So I'm interested in what changes and what doesn't change in an idiom that really stands the test of time. You know, I think that in some way it's a school of music, right? Even though it's super unschooled and raw, people are training their ears and their reflexes so that they can become the music that they love.
Yeah.
And you take out so much of that aspirational work when you say, oh, it's this simple, brutal music that anybody can play, you know, you can like just ham fisted, because the way that people approach it, I think, is so much more studied than that in a funny way. So I really am fascinated with this constant push and pull between the accessibility and immediacy of the music and the depth of the history and the fact that everybody who plays it seriously is an amateur historian by dint of immersion.
Okay, we're into the top two here, and like I said, I seem to have a thing in my old age for singer-songwriters, for storytelling songwriters, and for people who are really writing evocative music, and that's come up a few times in this episode as well. The second on my list is a record by Jacob Brodovsky, who's been on the podcast a number of times, or twice maybe, that's a number. He's been on twice, twice as himself, and once as a member of Kakagi, which was a really great band that I was a big fan of. I really like their songs for some of the same reasons I like Jacob's solo stuff. But he put out this LP that came out earlier this year, and it's, in my opinion, the best thing he's done, and I really like his previous releases, so that's high praise, I guess you could call it. But the record's called I Love You and I'm Sorry. It's all the reasons I basically just said that I like kind of that type of songwriting is there. I feel like Jacob's lyrics are extremely personal, extremely sort of connected to telling stories of specific people and specific places. Often, you know, it's in his own voice, but often it's describing other people. A lot of my favorite songwriters, locally or otherwise, kind of have the ability to do that and to really, really set the scene and the stage and the setting of a song. And this is just a great album. From the album cover, which has him sitting with a dog, that's always a win for me if you got a dog on your cover. But it's just a great record. I listened to it when I got it over and over again, and I love his voice, I love his songwriting, and Jacob is someone I think who deserves so much more credit for his writing than I think he does. I think his songs are well respected, and I think that he gets a lot of positive reviews and things about his music, but the songwriting is just it's awesome. And this record is kind of his peak so far. And, you know, he's young. He's only released a few EPs until now. So I think this is just the start, hopefully, of yet more great music. So I Love You and I'm Sorry, Jacob Brodowski. Please check it out. Here's a clip from my interview with Jacob this year, which was his third appearance on the podcast, and a song. How do those songs feel now that you've sat with them and lived with them for this long? Do they feel old to you now? I mean, I know they're new to everyone else, but is there any kind of like feeling of like, oh, I've moved on past this stuff now that it's been this long? Or are you still as excited about
them? No, absolutely. I hate them and I cannot wait to get them out so I can move on. Yeah.
I think that's a perfectly reasonable answer though too, right?
I mean, yeah, if the pandemic hadn't happened, they would have been out probably 2 years ago. So, but at the same time, I can live with them. Like, there's certainly previous work where, like, I, you know, 6 months out, I'm just like, let's never speak of this again. and this stuff, I'm still happy with. I'm still proud of it. It's not exciting to play as much as it was, but I'm also sort of trying to do this thing where, like, I'm going to have different live videos and stuff and really test out, like, I like the idea that a good song can sort of stand up no matter how you dress it up. So we're trying to do, like, all these different sort of live videos and different band arrangements and trying to reimagine the songs in different ways. And cool. So it's sort of like rediscovering them a little bit and kind of trying to keep them interesting, at least to myself, because otherwise I'll never play them again.
Well, you also have the benefit, I guess, too, of being able to introduce these to people as well, right? I mean, because as you're rolling them out, it's going to be new to the whole audience, so that there's at least that novelty aspect of it.
Totally, yeah. And, like, you know, I've tried them a lot. Like, some of these songs I've been playing live for a while, and so I kind of, yeah, it'll be nice to have them out, and I haven't released music in so long. I'm excited to sort of have one more kick at the can and kind of keep going a bit. But but yeah, it's, you know, I'm not big into touring for a variety of reasons, but I certainly would not be enthused to play these songs every night for a year.
Do you think that kind of feeling is going to make you move quicker on putting out a follow-up, or are you still, I mean, because like you said, you haven't put out any music in quite a while. It's kind of a long gap in between.
Yeah.
Are you like passionate about kind of getting this new stuff out as well as the stuff that's already in the can?
Yeah, in theory, yes. In practice, we'll see. I've got most of the next record written right now. I've been working on the last year, and in theory, I'd like to get it done quickly and whatever. But you know, that also, like, you know, takes money and time.
Of course,
I
have
a job too, and so we'll see. But I also, you know, I don't know. I sort of a mentor of mine has always advised me to take my time with things and you know, sit with it and really, really stew with it for a long time and sort of wrestle with the songs, which, so, you know, it's not like I've got, you know, thousands of ravenous fans just, you know, waiting for the next song to drop. So I kind of feel like I have the luxury of taking my time.
Right. Right. Well, with your last EP, your last solo EP, it seemed like, it seemed like the way it was rolled out and the way it was promoted, it seemed like it was much more kind of professionally done than previous stuff that you'd been involved with. And it seemed, as a result, it seemed higher profile, just because I saw you appearing on shit, you know, like, just more often. You'd be on show posters or videos coming up online, or you know, it was just out there kind of in the,
yeah,
floating around in the ether, like, more prominently. How does that side of things work now? Because, you know, like, it's still this weird wild west of no one. Some people aren't playing shows. Some people are. Like, do you do a live stream? It's all up in the air, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a few shows. I've gotten better at being choosier. Like, I'm so addicted to attention, right? And, like, I really love playing live, and it's really, like, my favorite thing in the world. But I've also learned that, you know, to play every other week, no one's going to show up,
right?
Or not, at least not for me. For other folks, you know, absolutely, but. So I played a few shows. I played a show in November, and I've got a show coming up in May. But I'm trying to be a little bit choosier with that stuff and just trying to, you know, focus on making those shows really special and cool and not sort of oversaturating myself too much.
Okay. Does, I assume that these songs, the new songs, I guess the old new songs, whatever you want to call them, I assume that they work kind of in a band setting as well as just stripped down acoustically, because that's probably how you wrote them, right? Do you have, like, is this set kind of malleable enough that you could potentially just have a full band and do the thing, you know, big and loud, and then you can also be just as happy doing it solo in the corner in a small venue?
That's certainly the goal. And I've sort of been kind of cutting it down the middle a little bit these last couple shows. I did in November, I opened for the Weather Station, and I've been playing. So I recorded the record with Jason Tate.
Cool.
Who's like my favorite drummer in the world, and he used to play in the Weekends.
Bunch of other projects,
Bahamas and, you know, Redfish and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so him and I have kind of been playing as a duo, which has been super fun. So just like acoustic guitar and drum kit. So there's it still kind of feels a little bandy. There are a little bit more dynamics and stuff, but it's still pretty bare bones. And then I'm working on some new stuff, some videos right now of the same tunes that I'm making with this band, the Funky Miracles, which is sort of Roman Clark and John Barron,
okay,
Austin Parahoniak and Kieran Plasetka. They're sort of like 70s funk revival band, and having them kind of reinterpret the tunes. And so, yeah, it's fun. I don't know. It's been fun doing a whole bunch of different things. I like playing solo too. I just, you know, playing solo for a captive audience is amazing and like the best feeling in the world. And playing solo for a band that want for a bar full of people that wants to hear a band is soul crushing. So I'm trying to be, you know, realistic and I guess sort of, you know, intentional with sort of how I present the tunes in different shows.
Yeah. I like the idea of having like a funky thing, kind of like, you know, reinterpreting your stuff, because I mean, that's maybe far from what I expect when I think about your songs, but is that something that you're kind of open to? Is it getting other collaborators to sort of take raw material and do something to it?
I love it. Yeah. Honestly, we were just jamming for the first time at Roman's last week, and like, it was so much fun. And I also think it's hilarious because a lot of these songs are really sad. So to present them in this like really not obnoxious, but kind of obnoxious, like sort of, you know, meters-y 70s or like band kind of thing. It's been really fun. I think my favorite part of writing songs is hearing how other people interpret them. Because I can go all day, I can track all the stuff and make it sound like how it sounds in my head, but that's specific to my brain.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to hear how, like, you know, other people interpret them and sort of apply their own influences and their own tastes to them.
And once they're gone out of your head onto some kind of recording, it's out of your control anyway, right? I mean, the way people are going to feel it and hear it and, yeah.
Totally. And I try not to be too precious about it. Like, it's, I'm lucky to have a lot of really talented pals and you know, the community is so supportive and collaborative. It's just, it's fun. It's a fun way to hang out. It's just to work on songs, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So what is your sort of plans for the near future as far as playing shows and things? I mean, I know you have the record that you're hoping to put out soonish, but do you have like a bunch of stuff set up, or you just have a few shows for now and you're gonna see how it goes from there?
Yeah, just a few shows for now. Like, I have my wife and I run a summer camp. That was the other sort of big change. Like, I've always been a camp person, but we kind of took over the camp we grew up at over the pandemic. So that's cool. Occupies a bit more of my time than it had previously, but it's also nice to kind of have a day job. And it's pretty, you know, the summers are really jam packed, but then it's quite flexible during the off season. So it's kind of a nice balance. And so, yeah, so I've got this show in May. I'm going to sort of, I think, roll out the singles over the summer. Maybe a few gigs over the summer, but maybe not. I'll probably be at camp for most of it. And then I want to do a big classic, like Winnipeg CD release, like West End show.
Yeah.
In the fall or winter. And then I'm hopping off, putting some touring, some European touring together for early 2023.
Cool.
The night Baker leaves the lights on in the basement, even though he never goes down there. The night Baker wants a Christian now, a Quaker leaves his shoes on when he walks downstairs. Still he doesn't believe in ghosts, and he's not afraid of the dark. He just doesn't want anyone to watch him while he falls apart. a night, Baker steals a kilogram of cinnamon, more than he will ever need. The night, Baker wants a giver now, a taker, if only he had mouths to feed. Since she told him she couldn't stay, and he didn't have the strength for a fight. It's been months now since she moved away, since he started working nights. The sourdough sarcastically mocks him. The bagels, they beg him to stay. The gluten-free flour calls out once every hour, "Hey, night baker, are you okay?" Another baked teenager on the doorstep asking for some bread. The night baker knows he'll one day meet his maker once the voice is quiet in his head. And he can finally become a ghost, free of drugs that were never prescribed. He'll never be insulted by toast. He can lie and watch the bread rise. He can lie and watch the bread rise. He can lie and watch the bread rise.
So usually when I'm at the number one spot, at my favorite episode, favorite song, usually when I'm at the number one spot for my favorite release of the year, local release, there's often a lot of kind of figuring out which one deserves it, which one should I give this spot to. If you read my list last year, which wasn't released as a podcast, but it came out online as just a list, I think I said even, or maybe it was the year before, I think I said that the numbers don't matter. These are all great records. They're in an order sort of loosely, but just take whatever. But this year, it was pretty easy, I think. One of my favorite local artists, who's been one of my favorite local artists for a long time, is Scott Nolan. I think he's kind of this hidden gem in Winnipeg. And I know hidden sounds weird, because I know he's well-known, well-respected, well-loved as an artist and as a songwriter and as a musician, as a producer here in Winnipeg. But it often startles me that he hasn't had some kind of like crazy success because of just the quality of his work. And you know, I always like his songwriting. I especially love his very deep local roots and the way that Winnipeg is represented in his music and always has been. And you hear local references and local turns of phrase. And anyway, he's a songwriter, he's a singer, he's a poet. He does visual art with collages now. And all of that has kind of come together into this project called The Suburb Beautiful, which is a collaboration with Glenn Buhr, who is a conductor and arranger. And it takes kind of Scott's typical sort of stripped down singer-songwriter storytelling and adds all these extra layers of orchestrated music on top of it. So you get kind of a great song at its basics, and then there's this lush orchestration added, there's a choir involved, there's all these extra instruments that sort of you wouldn't normally hear on a project like this, and in collaboration between Scott and Glenn has made this really, really, really interesting album. There's sounds on it that I wouldn't expect on one of Scott's records, and yeah, I just love it. It was, for me, it was just an obvious choice. I mean, I knew kind of going into this year as soon as I heard this record, I knew this was going to be on my list. Easily the top three, probably the top one. And throughout the year, based on all the stuff I listen to, and I listen to a lot of local music, This Suburb Beautiful has remained as my number one choice of all the local albums I've heard for 2022. So I cannot recommend it strongly enough. Go see Scott live whenever you can, of course. I had him play in my backyard this summer for like a private show. We had a few people come out and watch it in the backyard, and that was amazing. But, you know, he plays, he's always playing. He's always playing shows, he's always writing, he's making new music. He has new music coming out. Just check it out. This is Scott Nolan, how you haven't heard him before, with just this extra layer to the songs. And I'm going to play a clip from my interview with Scott, which is his second or third appearance on the show as well. And then one of the songs, which is one of my favorite songs on the record, which, like I said at the beginning, deals with a very Winnipeg location, place and time and setting. And if you're from here, especially if you live in the west part of the city, I think you'll dig it. Thanks for listening to my top five, and stay tuned for an interview with the Filipino-Canadian power trio Humus on the next episode. Later.
It was fairly early on in the pandemic, but it was early in a pretty serious part of it. People were... It was the beginning of being afraid.
Yeah.
So we got a very modest audience. And, I mean, we started the idea at the West End when we were recording this record and kind of took it further at the park. And the basic idea was, where you have the groups in the center of the room and the audience around the group. And I remember I can't remember if it was the Maddies. It was somebody that I'm familiar with that come to a lot of shows that said to me, we chose to sit behind Joanne. You really could kind of go in the room and go, I think I'd like to sit behind Joanne and see the mechanics of that and what it sounds like and feels like that from that part of the room. And so you had that visual. And then, of course, the sound was, comparable to a normal show. So
yeah.
Glenn Buer that I've made this new record with, he did this kind of stuff a bit with him and Bramwell Tovey started the new music festival.
Okay.
And I remember when I first went, it was Joanna Miller, in fact, that took me to my first one, and I'd never seen classical or symphony music performed, and so it was the new music, and there were bleachers on the stage. I remember going in and going, what the? And she said, we could go sit up there if you want. I thought, oh, my God, I couldn't believe it. And so it's very different. It's very different than your traditional audience member thing. And it was that. We were trying to kind of do that. Create a little bit of the Blue Note vibe, where we would have tried to keep it tight but loose. So every week was different and different material and that's how I started and built up my career, at least locally, was doing these things that, looking back at them now, whether it was deliberate or not, it was almost like some sort of installation of sorts where you saw something really grow. 10 years at the Bella Vista alone, the songwriting grew. If you cared for it, you could see all this stuff happening in real time, which I think is, that's what I grew up seeing and being influenced by, so...
Well, it's a cool way to sort of, even over a short period, to sort of grow with the artist that you're going to see as well. I mean, just watching the ins and outs, whether it's night after night or month after month or however something like that is set up, just giving the chance to especially with songs that are often developing too on stage. I mean, you can see different versions and the way that things kind of change until you hear the finished recorded version, and that's might be different than the past three times you heard the song.
And even after the recorded version, I mean, ultimately, one thing's for sure, the Holmes brothers, who got to know the great gospel blues group, I mean, they really made clear to me the concept of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts, and that, the drummer could speed up and slow down, and there were certain things that were like maybe musical vulnerabilities within the group, but when the three men played together, they had something that you couldn't, no level of kind of virtuosity could achieve that. It was just physical hours in a room, in church, through boyhood, to where I feel like Joanna and I have this, and you know, Paul Balkane, who is playing in the group, has on and off from my whole career. He's always kind of maybe almost right away had that some ability to or willingness, you know, to hear whatever it was I was trying to do and augment it, you know.
Well, so, and I mean, obviously this whole situation the world has been in, this has clearly affected the plans to release this record, I'm sure. I mean, you know, it's been 2 years. I imagine you had some of those songs figured out well before this release that's coming up. What has it been like sort of having this enforced, you know, separation from other musicians that you would normally be working with on a regular basis, and just this sort of, I guess, enforced solitude, really, you know, over the past 2 years as a creative person, as an artist?
I already really lived that way, to be truthful.
Yeah.
But actually maybe had less of an impact on me than many. And this project, it was already kind of an over a few years kind of concept, in that I had written the songs and created these work tapes that kind of were where Glenn began.
Okay.
Initially creating arrangements and then ultimately creating kind of what we both call expansions, because, you know, there is a collaborative thing that happened. He's taking music I wrote, but he's reimagining certain parts of it. And it was really at my encouragement. The first couple of things we did were kind of very thoughtful and brilliant arrangements. But I was the one that kind of encouraged him to turn up the glen. You could turn up the glen.
Okay.
I could hear a little bit more of that in there. And that's, and then to me, I feel like it was a song on the record called Patron Saint of Broken Hearts. I feel like there was that shift. Where suddenly there was like this really long intro and long outro to an otherwise regular Scott Nolan song, you know, and I thought, oh my, that was the first time I had a wow, like I was really, the possibilities and the beauty of it became like, I thought, okay, you know, that's so, but it was already a long, over long term thing. So now I don't know, really, I can't say as I have little to complain about, and the timeline of this project, I don't know that it was that impacted. The waiting on the vinyl was a little bit impacted, but even that, you know, and I think Glenn and I have this in common. I mean, for me, I've been doing this particular type of thing, which is different than what he does, for a long time. And the urgency is not what it was for me as a 20 or 30 year old person. You know, I've never even looked at like Spotify numbers, and I've never touched any of those things.
Yeah.
Convinced myself a long time ago, for better, for worse, whatever they were, probably wouldn't be good for me in some way or another, you know, really.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I don't know. What's it worth to my goal and my kind of... So, but anyway, so yeah, we hired Roberta Landreth, who helped us do this beautiful layout. So there was layers to this, you know, the LP in particular. We wanted to make something that was a substantial piece of art that you could hold in your hands. And so there's a booklet, and there's a lot of my collages in there, as well as a beautiful lithograph from Charles Simpson from, I don't know, 1930 maybe. And so there's all these kind of neat things. So it was like, yeah, there was a lot to it. So I never really felt rushed or worried. And then we started working with a little kind of very small, I think, PR firm in Montreal that are already kind of already showing us all the things we don't know, you know. So it's fun, you know. It's different than, you know, the record business has changed, for one, even since I last put out a record. And I've never really done those jobs, so I don't bring any skill to the table in a lot of regards. So, yeah, the timeline's been fine for me. And even the show coming up, The way this whole thing began was the Penderecki String Quartet were here in Winnipeg playing, I believe, the Agassiz Festival.
Okay.
And Glenn, they're all old dear friends. Glenn, they were all at Laurier University in Kitchener-Waterloo in the music program for years. So it, you know, from him and I kind of creating this in our minds to like, okay, here we go. Here's the arrangements and charts.
Yeah.
I got the Penderecki String Quartet. Now they just happen to be back, you know? So, and really the, even with the timing of it, a part of the reason we chose the matinee was it was their last day here. And I thought, geez, I have no problem with a matinee show, and they're kind of interesting and fun. And
yeah.
So, yeah, like the way this whole project began, we're going to release it locally that same way. Like, oh, geez, we're all in one place. Let's just do this right now. And so, yeah, it's all kind of just things take their natural course. I stopped sure. fighting those currents. They can really exhaust you, and that's a young person's struggle, I think.
Thank you. some more rain. Yellow light 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 some more rain.